You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 12th of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and indeed review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, and Clemency Burton-Hill.
Coming up on today's programme, the world has descended on London for its annual film festival. We'll be discussing some of this year's international titles with David Jenkins, editor of Little White Lies magazine.
전에 학교에 한 번 와봤었거든.
그래요?
그땐 되게 좋았어. 재미도 있고 옛날 생각도 나고.
All will be explained presently, and we're mixing our format up today, introducing a brand new review segment. Today we'll get the verdict on the new album by Lebanese group Mashru Layla.
With poetry, lucidity, and his signature sultry voice, Hamid highlights both our unwillingness to redress our society and our bizarre and perpetual obsession with futile distractions.
Plus, we'll fill you in on Berlin's weekend highlights, we'll take a critical perspective on some new exhibition openings in Madrid, and we'll explore some international artists who've been catching the ear of DJ and label owner Chris Tubbs, who we welcome back for our new music review.
A journey around the world from the comfort of your living room. Where else could you be but The Review on Monocle 24? Good afternoon and welcome to The Review from Studio One here at Midori House. I'm Andrew Muller here with Clemency Burton-Hill. Clemency, good afternoon.
Hello, Andrew.
Have you done anything cultural this week?
Well, I spent a rather indulgent couple of hours at the National Gallery yesterday afternoon, actually. I had some time off for the first time in what felt like about 17 years, and I thought I would go and check out the Facing the Modern exhibition, which is this extraordinary exhibition of Viennese portraiture at the turn of the last century. So you've got just breathtakingly beautiful pictures by Klimt, Gustav Klimt, Egon Schiele, Richard Gerstel, Oskar Kokoschka. But it's really fascinating as well, looking at the kind of sociological changes and the upheavals and that very depressing moment where you have Vienna, at the fin de siècle of Vienna, where everything is sort of liberal and reforming, and you've got this sort of emergence of a middle class who are doing really extraordinary things in the arts and sciences, and of course so many of them Jewish immigrants. And then before too long, you know where it's going to end and you know where it's going. So really interesting look at what's happening at the cusp of the century, and just some really wonderful art. So I highly recommend that.
Is it hard to enjoy the art in and of itself, though? Because as you said, everyone knows how this ends. Does that retrospectively imbue them with a certain melancholy?
Well, no, I mean, not at all, because some of the pictures are just so extraordinary. I mean, I particularly love the Egon Schiele, and there's a self-portrait that is just really, really remarkable. Some wonderful Gustav Klimt, as I say, and then some really interesting kind of cultural context as well. Obviously, being a kind of music obsessive, I was fascinated to see pictures by Arnold Schoenberg, the composer who's most famous for basically, well, some people would say ruining music as we know it, sort of doing away with tonality and creating the 12-tone system. But his wife, Matilda, was having an affair with another great painter, Richard Gerstel, who then committed suicide. There is an incredibly powerful self-portrait, naked self-portrait, the first nude self-portrait in Vienna ever, by Richard Gerstel, after which he committed suicide just moments, you know, not moments, a month or so afterwards. And then Alexander Zemlinsky, who was Matilda's brother, who's also in this kind of circle. And no, I think the art absolutely speaks for itself. And of course, then you've got people like Egon Schiele, who died actually, you know, long before anything else happened. He died in the Spanish flu epidemic. And there's an incredibly poignant, beautiful pencil drawing of his wife as she was about to die of the flu. And then he dies 3 later. I'm making it sound very, very gloomy. And it's in fact a rather uplifting exhibition, because the art is just wonderful. And it's a really well-curated exhibition. It's not, I mean, I spent quite a long time there because I just loved the art, but you know, you can do it in an hour or so, and it's sort of quite full of gems, but it's not overwhelming, which I always think is good. What about you, Andrew?
Really very little, because I've mostly been in here yammering into this microphone, but I will keep this very brief. There is culture of a sort happening at my house this afternoon, which is the beginning of rehearsals for the Dublin revival of the North Sea Scrolls at the Royal National Concert Theatre, not Royal, not in Dublin. National Concert Hall in Dublin. Myself, Cathal Coughlan and Luke Haynes are playing there on November the 2nd with possibly the last performance of our North Sea Scrolls song cycle.
Ever. Can people still get tickets to go?
Tickets,
to
I believe, are still available, yes. You are listening to The Review on Monocle 24. And the London Film Festival is underway now for the 57th time. London's Film Festival has come to pride itself somewhat on being a film festival which isn't oppressively festival-like. It's as happy to extend due kudos to Hollywood blockbusters as it is to nine-hour-long silent black-and-white Iranian epics about a boy and his bucket.
The bigger ticket items at this year's film festival include Monday pirate drama Captain Phillips, starring Tom Hanks, which opened the festival on Wednesday, and Enough Said, a romantic comedy starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus and the late, great James Gandolfini. But as they'll be getting enough attention, we thought we would consider some of the festival's international offerings. And I'm delighted to say that joining us in the studio to talk us through his selection is David Jenkins, editor of Little White Lies magazine. David, thanks very much for joining us here this afternoon. I know you've just hot-footed it over from the Trocadero in Leicester Square, where you were seeing a screening this morning. First of all, I mean, is the film festival just a kind of mad frenzy of film going?
Oh, it is. It's. I mean, one of the joys of all film festivals, I think, is that kind of two-week preamble where you have the programmes in, the press screening schedules are in, the interview possibilities are kind of drip-feeding through, and you can just sit down with your colleagues and work out who's going to see what, who's going to do what, and just trying to make this Herculean effort to really cover just everything that is humanly possible. Sleep is for losers during the London Film Festival, I think, is what a lot of journalists say to one another. And, you know, it's early mornings and late nights. And I think this year especially, it's the offerings have been made even more kind of diverse and tough to pick, because there's a new kind of rota of press and industry screenings happening at the salubrious Trocadero Centre, no less. So aside from all the kind of films that we have in the programme, we have, you know, this huge amount of, you know, other films that we can, you know, there's more selection this year, I think, and it's made it even tougher to just lock down what you want to see.
We should possibly explain for our non-London listeners that the Trocadero Centre is not normally associated with the sort of artistic end of the cinematic spectrum. It's largely a venue in which large crowds of continental tourists carrying fluorescent backpacks gather to buy Princess Diana coffee mugs. What were you actually seeing this morning?
Well, this morning I was actually seeing it. I mean, one of the things I like about the festival is that So one of the other main venues is the View West End, which is a similar kind of multiplex. And I think there's something quite satisfying seeing these very strange art house, European, Asian, these films in these, you know, spangly, shiny, fluorescent multiplex cinemas. And this morning I was up.
Do you eat popcorn while you're watching?
No, that's
that would be very frowned upon.
That would be madness.
Well, let's start with some of these slightly more unapologetically arty films. You've picked a slate for us. Where do you want to begin?
Well, the first film I've picked is I don't think it would probably count as unapologetically arty. It's foreign language, but I think that's probably the furthest you can go. It's a movie called We Are the Best by the Swedish director Lukas Moodysson.
There is an exclamation mark at the end of that title, which I think is important.
Oh, should I have shouted that?
Well, just a sort of a slight punch home emphasis on the best. So we are the best.
Indeed.
Something like that.
Yeah. I can explain why the exclamation mark is there, actually. So Moodysson is this Swedish director, and what he's brought us with We Are the Best is that thing that everyone loves, which is a kind of big return to form. He made these very, very beloved films in the late 90s called Together and Show Me Love. I mean, I don't like the word feel good, but they were very feel good films and I think embraced by a lot of people. And then he kind of went on this weird kind of dirge where he started making very, very dark, bleak, less kind of films that are less easy to sort of, you know, take into your arms. And We Are the Best is a return to, I think, what he does best. And it's a film about three 12, 13-year-old schoolgirls. They've all got kind of weird punk hairdos. And the film
takes... Because it's 1982.
Yeah. The film takes place in sort of that kind of post-punk era in Stockholm. And there's not really a story to it. The girls have they're playing dodgeball, and their sports teacher tells them off for not joining in the game properly. And as they're being forced to do laps, they decide to write a song about their sports teacher. And this develops into them starting a punk band, because they all listen to punk music. And there's a youth centre that has a drum kit and a bass guitar. And they just, from there, start a punk band. And the film just sort of charts their friendship, their kind of creative development, the influence of punk on sort of a younger audience and younger generation. And it's also a film that, you know, you don't have to like punk to enjoy the film, because it's, you know, it kind of examines quite sort of universal things like, you know, just friendship among teenagers and the pangs of first love and stuff like that. So it's very, very funny, and Mudison manages to sort of elicit these incredible naturalistic performances from his kind of young, almost preteen cast.
Much great music has, of course, been made as an expression of rebellion or dissatisfaction with school teachers. Lynyrd Skynyrd, no less, named themselves after their own PE teacher, Lynyrd Skynyrd. We do have a clip, I think, of We Are the Best.
Äckligt, var det hår?
Men sluta.
Alltså, är det ägg?
Punken är död, har ni inte fattat det än?
Den är inte död.
Är det så jävla mycket rök här inne?
Fan, vi är inte 12.
Nej, men det är väl för fan inte jag heller. Jag är inte 12, jag är 13.
Bara för att det var jag som bokade, ja. Behöver det väl vara jag som också tar tvätten?
Lucas Moodysson's We Are the Best. I'm sure any of our Swedish listeners out there will have understood that, but it certainly gave us a sense of the colour. David, what else has caught your eye at the festival?
Well, so the film I was seeing this morning at the Trocadero was a film called Ao Sun-hee by the South Korean director Hong Sang-soo. He is a director who's very sort of little known in this country, even though he's been making films since 2000, and he makes them at an extremely swift rate as well. I mean, this is his second film this year. He's also got another film in the festival called Nobody's Daughter, High One. And he's a filmmaker who's never been distributed in the UK before. And Nobody's Daughter, High One was actually his first of about 17 or 18 films to actually make it into cinemas here. He's a kind of brilliant filmmaker that you have to have seen lots of his films to really kind of understand and appreciate the new ones. Mm. Ao Sun-hee is about a girl and a young student, and she meets with her college lecturer who's going to give her a recommendation letter for a university in the US. And the whole film kind of spins off this recommendation letter that he gives her, and it's about the notion of saying things about other people, telling people how you feel about them. And the way the film's made, one of the things in Hong Sang-soo's film, which is a kind of staple, is that he likes exploring how people express themselves in different states of sobriety. So during the film, Sun-hee gets quite drunk with the three male protagonists of the film, and we kind of see how their expression changes once they've had lots of soju to drink. And he also sort of implements these very little kind of symmetries in the plot, and these very bizarre comic kind of happenstance moments where in each of the bars that Sun-hee's drinking, the same song comes on. It's three different cafes, but the same song comes on the radio, this weird kind of Korean chanson. And these films are very funny. They almost feel very, not slapdash, but they feel kind of rooted in sort of almost like Shakespearean comedy or even like French literature, you know, French comedies. And they've got this kind of classical feel to them, even though they're made very quickly, very cheaply. In this 90-minute film, there must have been, 30 shots or something? I mean, he doesn't cut. He doesn't, doesn't really use editing. He just lets the camera sit still and lets his actors emote, and they say their dialogue, and it's, you know, he's a brilliant filmmaker, and I kind of wish more people would know about him.
Well, hopefully they will now.
But you do say it's necessary, though, to see a few of his films before you get the idea. What is it that in the initial encounters with his work may be off-putting?
Well, I mean, just because I think he has this kind of self-referential streak. I mean, I think some of his detractors accuse him of making the same film over and over again. But I think once you've seen a lot of them, you kind of see that it's actual kind of subtle variations. I mean, the kind of great French filmmaker Eric Rohmer, is someone who's often brought up in when you talk about Hong Sang-soo, in that, you know, he made these films in the 80s, which just seemed like the same woman walking around, being annoyed, being, you know, indecisive. And by examining this sort of similar subject over and over again, you kind of tease out the intricacies, and I think that's what he does. And also just the fact that he has in every film, I think about 17 of his films, and I think in every single one there's a shot of along a table full of empty soju bottles, and the two main protagonists are drunk, and it's the kind of vino veritas talk that they have to each other. And once you've seen it like 14 times and it comes up again, it's like an old friend. And yeah.
Let's move over to something completely different. Computer Chess. That's set in 1980, again, a bit of an 80s theme emerging perhaps this year, where computer programmers gather for a tournament that pits their chess programs against each other. Sounds like, you know, thrilling premise for a drama, but actually supposed to be incredibly charming. Tell us more.
This is a film by a director called Andrew Bajalski. He's known as the kind of king of what's termed mumblecore, which is these American movies of young people just talking, and they're very kind of loose. I think you call them hangout movies, just people talking about their feelings. And when I saw this film, it was hard to understand that he would have made a film like this, because it's so different from the preceding works. It takes place over a weekend in a very kind of ramshackle hotel in Austin, Texas, over a weekend in the 80s. And it's a chess tournament where programmers from all over the states have kind of amassed in this hotel with their chess programs that they've developed. And each chess program plays each other in a tournament. And in the end, the winning chess program, it gets to play a human player. And it almost makes it sound like it's a sports movie, where you're sort of, you know, you meet different characters and you're rooting for different characters. And it's got this very wry, very dry sense of humor to it. It's all shot on these video cameras from the era, in this very, very, very grainy black and white, lots of like static, and the picture shifts, and it feels very retro in that respect. But actually, underneath it all is this movie that's far deeper. And what you feel you're seeing is like there's an apocalyptic feel to it, in that we've got these young minds thinking about technology, thinking about computer programming, and they're making these programs which are essentially strategy programs, which we later find out the military are interested in their, you know, they're following their work, and they're, you know, they're wondering how they can use these programs in their own work. So it has this kind of overriding apocalyptic feel to the whole thing, that you maybe get the sense that the people making these programs don't quite understand.
We do have a clip from Computer Chess.
Two sides, different colors. One of them's got to win, one of them's got to lose.
I greet you for our annual North American Computer Chess Tournament. I present you with the best and the brightest. And we have something new this year. We have a lady who is competing way in the back corner. There she is.
I'd be willing to bet that you and I are the only ones here who even understand that programming has a feminine side. I would love to stay in your room if you have an extra bed.
Don't you think it's strange that we're all here at the same time?
War is death. Hell is pain.
Clip from Computer Chess, another recommendation from the London Film Festival by our guest film reviewer David Jenkins of Little White Lies magazine. David, just finally, is there anything coming up in particular that you're really looking forward to?
Ooh.
There's so many.
Yes, yeah, it's tough to choose.
See
from
that
actually.
That bulging programme you've brought into the studio here.
There is another film that I've seen, which I don't think is played in the festival yet, which is very good, by a British filmmaker called Ben Rivers. He's something of an experimental filmmaker, and his work kind of harks back to Hammer Horror, Nick Rogue, people like that. And he's made this extraordinary film collaborating with another art filmmaker called Ben Russell, called A Spell to Ward Off the Darkness. And he shoots his films on film. And this film is a kind of triptych about a guy traveling through Scandinavia. First, he's in a commune. Secondly, he's kind of traveling through this kind of rocky landscape. And thirdly, it's this extraordinary sequence where he's playing in a kind of pagan black metal band. And you see these three very different styles of filmmaking during the film, and the time is filtered in different ways. And it's a really extraordinary work. And he's definitely one of Britain's great kind of unknown filmmakers.
I've heard some critics saying that it will absolutely reward and prove fascinating and compelling for those who are willing to kind of be carried away by its sights and sounds. One critic said, though, mainstream audiences are likelier to run for the hills, some of which they concede are beautifully photographed.
Yes.
Do you think that's fair to say?
Well, you know, there is a toughness to it, but I mean, it's... I think if you're someone who can just sort of let images and sounds roll over you and take in textures, and you're looking for something bigger than just a sort of conventional narrative, then I think A Spell to Ward Off the Darkness might be up your alley.
David Jenkins, editor of Little White Lies magazine, thanks for joining us. There's still the week to go of the London Film Festival, so if you are in the city, visit bfi.org.uk/LFF for more details. But if you're not, all of these titles are or will be available internationally.
You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. After this short break, we'll be critiquing music from Lebanon and beyond.
You've read the magazine, you've listened to the radio, and you've even made it to our new cafe. But now there's more, so much more. Hitting bookshelves this September is Monocle's first book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living. It's a quiet manifesto for doing things well that runs from the macro to the micro. Over 400 pages of fresh editorial, great illustrations, and stunning photography. We look at what makes a great city, how to build a home you'll always love, why it's good to have a Shiba Ken dog by your side and a cocktail from the Dragonfly Bar in your hand. The Monocle Guide to Better Living will be available in good bookshops around the world and is also available to order now at monocle.com. Happy reading.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there, and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love, generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, and Clemency Burton-Hill. We're going to be mixing things up on The Review over the coming weeks, and in place of our global look ahead, we're now asking Monocle staff and correspondents from around the world to share some of their new discoveries with us.
So first up is Sally Mousavi, who's picked out the new album by Lebanese group Mashrou Leila. Here she is to explain why she thinks it's one worth adding to your music collection.
If the name doesn't sound familiar from the countless times we have played them here on M24, Mashrou Leila is a Lebanese band that first appeared on the Beirut independent music scene in 2008. Still sprouting during the early days of the Arab Spring, today the band is blooming. The group's eponymous first album and their second album, El Harr Mensi, are both delicately yet shamelessly laced with politics, sex, obscenities, and hard truths. 5 years on, they continue to set the standard for politicized music, jamming all over conventions in a deeply conservative region. This year, Mashrou Leila, or Leila, as they are intimately referred to by their friends and fans, have finally brought us a third album. Ra'a Souk, which translates as They Choreographed You, is something of a turning point for Leila. From the album art, designed by lead singer Hamid Sinno himself, to the sound of the instruments and the depth of the lyrics, everything about this album feels superior. From the production side, the album is a milestone. Determined not to be at the mercy of a record label that might want to turn down the crescendo, Leila crowdfunded over $66,000 to produce Ra'a Souk completely independently. In doing so, they bypassed the tentacles of the Lebanese censorship machine. This was a very wise move, and the success of the crowdfunding effectively makes Ra'a Souk the biggest independent music release the Arab world has seen. On the artistic side, the album is truly unique. It's clear the band challenged themselves musically and lyrically to move away from their genre. From one track to the other, Layla glides from ballad to jazz, touching on synth pop and rock along the way. In the band's own words, the album is about everything. Love, lust, mourning, social control, Lebanese politics, the Arab Spring, and most importantly, dancing. The strongest track on the album is called Del Watan, for the homeland. The lyrics say, every time you demand change, they accuse you of betraying the herd. They make you despair until you sell out all your freedom. They tell you to stop preaching and come dance with them. Speak to any young Lebanese today who has been shut down for daring to dream of change, and they'll sing the same tune. With poetry, lucidity, and his signature sultry voice, Hamed highlights both our unwillingness to redress our society and our bizarre and perpetual obsession with futile distractions. This is satire at its finest. For Monocle, I'm Sally Moussaoui.
And if you liked what you heard there, Mashru Layla took time out of their tour last week to play a Midori House session for Robert Bound's Culture Show. That'll be on air at 1900 hours London time on Monday. That's 1400 hours on the east coast of the US.
It's time now to hear some choice tracks from music industry aficionado. And today I'm thrilled to welcome back DJ, producer, label consultant and record label owner Christopher Tubbs to the programme.
Chris has picked some artists from around the world who've caught his ear recently and he's here to share them with us. Chris, welcome back to the show. You were last here around July 20th. I believe.
Something like that. I'm sorry, I'm still stuck on record industry aficionado. I like that. That's a t-shirt.
You can have that.
You can get your business cards altered afterwards. What have you been doing in the couple of months since then?
Well, a lot of what I do is essentially I try and match culture and specifically music to brands. Generally luxury brands. So I have been basically kind of immersed in that world. Nothing very glamorous. I'm not really doing that much DJing at the moment, which is very sad, actually, because usually summer is encompasses lovely trips to Ibiza and all sorts of things. But real life has impacted recently. So that's what I'm up to.
I'm sure there'll be listeners going, though, I want that real life. If that's real life, you know, not having to be stuck behind a desk somewhere boring all day long. Tell us about the tracks you've chosen this morning. We're going to kick off with Daniel Mathieu. C'était un beau dimanche.
Yes.
I'm glad you said that.
Yeah, with so much more verb and land I would have managed, that's for sure. Daniel Mathieu, I think he made one album, and he's one of these guys that particular album has gone down in sort of alt-rock history as being a lost gem. And copies of that record can be found on eBay for over £800. I mean,
wow.
It's a really, really special record. And for some reason, the guy has never liked it being licensed until now. And it's appeared on this fantastic compilation that has to be bought if you don't own it already. It's by Psych Magic, and it's called Magic Sunrise, which is a slightly wishy-washy title for a compilation, but it's...
Psych Magic, spelled P-S-Y-C-H-E-M-A-G-I-K, in case people are now frantically looking for it online.
As if you'd spell it any other way. Shall we listen to a bit of this?
Yes, let's do it.
The That's quite a weird track. I keep thinking it's going to turn into one of those big late 70s power ballads like More Than a Feeling by Boston or something. It all at once has something of a riff of the twin-necked guitar.
And really?
That big sort of 12-string part, and yet also that weird keyboard riff that sounds like it was played on one of those stupid keyboards that people used to wear like a guitar in the 80s.
Really? Good Lord. Yeah.
He's hard to please.
That's not the imagery I see at all.
None of that is necessarily a bad thing, by the way.
I love how it combines, well, sort of the folkiness with the electronica. I think that's a really great combination.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that particular synthesizer he was playing was a very early ARP keyboard, which had been one of those enormous contraptions that took up a whole wall with just a sea of plugs and wires.
So indeed the very opposite of one you could wear over your shoulder.
Yes, absolutely.
That's me told.
Absolutely. So it's interesting because Daniel is, as I say, one like a one album wonder. He now conducts tours of Burgundy wine tours.
I'm willing to bet he owns at least one twin neck guitar.
You think?
Yeah.
Maybe one of those sort of rubber blow-up ones.
I tell you what, I'll go on the Burgundy tour, drink a load of wine and ask him. How about that?
Do ask him. I think the twin-neck guitar is overdue a rehabilitation. I think it has been stigmatized due to the whole Eagles thing far too long. I fear we are deviating from the point somewhat, which are the music selections of Christopher Tubbs, this week's guest reviewer. Your second pick today, this is Rob... I'm going to have a slap at the surname Mel. Mel, M-E-H-L.
I think Mel.
Let's go with Mel. If he's listening, he can write in and object. Who is he?
Rob Mel is a bit of a journeyman singer-songwriter who emerged from that West Coast, as you say, the Eagles, in fact. Relevantly enough.
Another twin-neck guitar owner.
Nid Doheny.
A trend is emerging.
All of those lovely kind of blue-eyed soul surf rock guys from the mid-70s. And he exists in that very Southern Californian kind of smoked-out haze, slight psychedelic tendencies, but music with a message. It's all very positive, but it's all very sunshine.
Negotiating a path somewhere between Jackson Brown and Jimmy Buffett there. That's Rob Mayall, House on the Rock, the second selection by this week's guest music reviewer, Christopher Tubbs. Thinking about it more, he may not actually own a twin-neck guitar. I bet he's got a ukulele, though.
Oh, I bet he's got a ukulele.
Several, in fact, a collection.
I concur. Definitely. I thought two selections tonight, as the weather closes in and we sort of stagger into the long, dark tunnel of winter. I thought that was like a little bit of vitamin D.
I was going to say it was a bit of a shot of something. As you mentioned, it's getting very wintry indeed here in London. So anything that gives us a dose of Californian sunshine, I'm all for. Let's move on to B. Cougarman and General Z, or General Z, should I say.
General Z.
Except that they're an alias of London producers, so I'm assuming that they're General Z. What is it about this record that you like?
Well, these guys are fantastic record producers in the dance realm. And the records they make under their own names, Joel Martin and Jerry Rooney, are very much druggy, smoky, basement kind of dance music. This particular alias is essentially led towards edits, and edits are very rare, strange, quite dark music. So a lot of the subject material is a long, long way from Rob Mel and Daniel Mathieu. This is kind of edgy, slightly twisted, strange. God, have a listen.
We will. This is Susan Loves to Jack. Sue, Susan Loves to Jack by B. Kugerman and General Z, otherwise known as Joel Martin and Jerry Rooney. But we don't know who's singing on that.
No, we don't. This is something that emerges from edit culture, and that producers are very, very secretive about their sources. And what they've done to that track is essentially they've literally just thrown it through a compressor, muddied the sound a bit, and occasionally put in these disconcerting little pitch bends here and there to make you feel slightly seasick. But it's really about, edit culture is really about a reflection of the DJ and the producer who's putting the edits together, their record collection and the depth of their record collection. And it's essentially almost competitive, you know, who can put together the edit of the most obscure track possible. And people will argue for hours on forums, on dance music forums, as to what the source of this track should be. And you know,
how necessary for a complete appreciation of what they're doing is that kind of arcane knowledge which fills up yards and yards and yards of computer screen?
I think it's part of it, but I think if it's a really, really good selection, then it's just there to be enjoyed anyway.
It's an enhancement as opposed to a pre-requirement.
Yeah, it's a second level, yeah. Put it that way.
I imagine you have quite a deep record collection, Chris.
I, as my spectacles, which of course the listeners can't see, would reflect, I am a nerd. I am a record nerd par excellence.
And you, of course, you started a vinyl-only record label, Untracked. Is it all vinyl, your collection, your personal collection?
Yes. I mean, it goes into the tens of thousands.
In your home? Or
yes,
do you have a kind of
yes,
special
much,
storage
much
unit?
Much to my wife's chagrin, you know, the fact that it just spills out of every room and, you know, people trip over it and it's just a general blight on the landscape.
Glorious.
Except to me.
Of course. No, I can't. I think I trust a home that's filled with vinyl.
Yeah, but you describe yourself as a nerd, and I have a question to that in two parts to sort of just gauge where you are on the nerd scale. One, is it alphabetically indexed? And two, when you own more than one album by the same artist, are they shelved in chronological order of release?
No, you see, no. Only I know where my records are.
Yeah, that's not proper hardcore then.
No, because I disagree, because I think, well, maybe the chronology thing is hardcore nerdery, but I'm not sure about the alphabetical order thing, because then any old fool can just go and find, oh, I'm looking for a record that begins with a C, and it's obviously going to come between B and D. Yeah. But actually, as you say, like the real geekery comes from knowing.
Really? That's vaguely reassuring to me, because while I do have CDs...
So, see, I'm also a bit of a vinyl nerd, although not on the scale.
I do have CDs, which are, I confess, alphabetically arranged, but I don't do the whole chronological thing. But you think it's actually more nerdy just to have that internalised, personalised, custom-built filing system that makes no sense
I like
to anyone but you?
The idea of filing system in huge inverted commas. I think it's more a case of it's my library, therefore only I should understand.
Exactly. Well, someone who would fall under the category beginning with E, Emiliana Torini, excuse me.
I'd have filed her under T.
Oh, interesting. There you go. This is the problem with the whole alphabetization, Andrew. Andrew Weatherall remixed this track, Speed of Dark. He's a bit of a national treasure. She is from Iceland. Kind of extraordinary voice. Tell us more about this track.
It's very much in keeping with what Andrew Weatherall, a certain path he's been treading for the last 3 or 4 years, which is almost sort of smoky, bluesy electro, if such a thing exists.
I love that combination. Smoky, yeah, it's, bluesy it, electro.
It's a strange but wonderful combination. Very much reflects the man aesthetically as well as he presents himself to the world, both sonically and otherwise. But this particular remix of Emiliana Torino is a great representation of where she's going as well. She comes from a songwriting background in Iceland, has written for groups like Gus Gus, who were very prominent in the late 90s, and right up to sort of Paul Oakenfold, fairly questionable CV.
Interesting.
Addition. But there
unexpected.
We go.
Could you hear the disdain leaking out of his voice there for Paul Oakenfold?
Probably quite inappropriate.
I remember Gus Gus very fondly, though. I liked them. They were great.
So did I. Yeah. So did I. So she was a very essential part of that whole scene. And this is from her new album on Rough Trade. And I think it's a cracker.
We'll be right back.
Speed of Dark, Emiliana Torini in collaboration there with Andrew Weatherall, the final selection of this week's music reviewer, Chris Tubbs. Chris, thank you again for coming in. What do you have coming up that we'll be able to talk about next time?
Well, hopefully I'll have an opportunity at some stage to finish a record. I have a hard drive in various studios around London of music that I've been working on, and I am going to make it my mission this grim, as we go into this sort of grim period of London reality, that I will actually stay in a studio for longer than an hour and try and complete something, press it on 12-inch, and maybe if you guys are kind enough next time, I'll play it.
Yeah, perfect. And will that be under your own auspices or under the Atlantic Conveyor?
Gangs of Rome,
okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, we shall look forward to hearing that next time. For the moment, though, Chris Tubbs, thank you for joining us and bringing your music in.
Thanks so much.
The Entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push, maybe, that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
Thanks very much for joining us here on The Review on Monocle 24 with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, and Andrew Muller.
We're getting a bit European now for the rest of the show. In a moment, we'll be taking a critical perspective on some upcoming culture in Madrid. But first, it's time for our weekly city look ahead. Today, it's the turn of our Berlin correspondent, Kimberly Bradley, with her choices for coming days in the city.
Fall in Berlin means deliciously sunny days under colorful leafy trees, or the wet and dripping gray on gray of seemingly endless rain. Either way, there's always something going on. Right now, the Festival of Lights, which started on October 9th and runs to the 20th, illuminates no fewer than 70 of the city's major monuments and landmarks with a wildly colorful light show. See moving designs projected onto the Brandenburg Gate, Berlin's iconic TV tower, and many, many other structures throughout the city. You can view it on foot or as part of the festival's light-seeing tours. Those are by bus, bike, taxi, or car. There's even a Festival of Lights photography contest and a running race. I'd rather not see the electricity bill after this week is over. Those who prefer to stay inside and happen to love painting can tour the Berlin State Museums, which have collaborated this fall with several different exhibitions all titled Painting Forever. The Berlinische Galerie, a museum that shows art only made in Berlin, spotlights German painter Franz Ackermann. At Kunstwerke Contemporary Art Center is a huge wall of 70 paintings, all by currently active Berlin artists. And the Glassbox New National Gallery features a quartet of hot male painters, while the Deutsche Bank Kunsthalle shows an exhibition of 4 female painters. All of the exhibitions are up until November 10th. There's plenty on in the performing arts scene as well. Fans of improvisation can watch some of the world's best improv actors compete with each other in a championship called Impromania, running in several small Berlin theaters for a week, starting October 14th. Then, at the Staatsoper, or State Opera, there's a performance of a wildly modern dance piece called Caravaggio by acclaimed choreographer Mauro Bigonzetti. The State Opera is still running its performances in the Schiller Theater on the city's west side until its house renovations are done in 2 years' time. As the week rolls down, Berlin always goes out, sometimes for the whole weekend. Berghain, often touted as the world's best nightclub, opens its doors Friday night at 1 minute before midnight and features DJs Adalberto and Sven Weisemann. Quieter types like me, on the other hand, tend to quaff cocktails at Buck and Breck, a limited seating hidden bar on Brunnenstraße in Mitte. In Berlin, all kinds are welcome and accommodated. For Monocle and Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
Kimberly Bradley there, reporting from Berlin. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24.
And we're going to finish the show today with a stop-off in the Spanish capital. Why not? While Madrid is bemoaning the steady implementation of cutbacks to the cultural sector, and it's certainly not alone there, there are still some upcoming gems in the world of theatre, art and cinema.
Our Madrid correspondent Liam Aldous sat down with the cultural editor of El País's weekend magazine, El País Semanal, to get his picks. Jesús Ruiz Mantilla met Liam at a local cafe to give his insight into how Spain's cultural capital is continuing to thrive.
My name is Jesús Ruiz Mantilla, and I work for El País Semanal. It's the weekly magazine, the largest and the most influential newspapers magazine in the Spanish-speaking world.
One thing I've noticed in Madrid is that Madrileños love a spot of theatre, even despite the tax hikes and the downturn. They're still filling the theatres. So this time of the year brings some of the best productions, and some of them have even incorporated the tough times into their narratives, I see.
Well, Madrid is a spectacular town for theater lovers. And here comes the autumn. We're in the autumn right now, and the big season starts. And we have several choices here in Madrid. We have, for example, a new play by Jordi Garcelán, which is a famous worldwide Spanish author. He wrote a piece about the crisis and the fall of the construction sector in Spain, and he made such a black comedy. He was the author of The Granholm Method, which was an amazing piece on the work and on how to get a job, and it's a great piece, I think. And it's it's played by Carlos Hipólito, which is one of our greatest actors, and directed by Gerardo Vera, which is a great theatre director. And we have, for the fullness and the craziness, we have La Cubana, which is a great Catalan group. You know, these pieces of the joy of life and comic pieces is La Cubana. It's great. And we have also El Brujo, which is kind of the wizard in English. He's one of our great classical actors, and he makes adaptations of the Odyssey, for example, of Spanish classics, and makes it come to the present times, and it's a great show to see him. So it's a great opportunity if you come to Madrid and see this kind of theatre. It's full of life and full of talent.
Well, we've just recently celebrated Apertura, where the city's modern art galleries coordinate a huge selection of openings to usher in the new post-summer season. What else is on offer, and are there any blockbuster exhibitions that we should know about?
Well, Madrid is great for exhibitions as well. The autumn season starts with great exhibitions. We have a Velázquez exhibition in El Prado. Well, I wouldn't recommend that, because El Prado is full of Velázquez all the season. So if you want to stand in a big queue for seeing Velázquez portraits, you can go and spend like, don't know how much time, but an hour in a queue. So I think it's a little bit stupid to do that. But it's a great exhibition, of course. And but we have another one just in front of El Prado. It's about surrealism. And I think it comes from the big success that Dalí exhibition has had in the Reina Sofía for the last season. But now we have another point of view in surreal, like a most popular avant-garde. And we have Breton things, we have Noguer things, Magritte, and all the surreals around Dali as well. But we have another kind of jewelry here called Méliès. Well, it's an exhibition about Méliès, this wizard of the beginning of the movie making of cinema. It's in the Caixa Forum, and it's all around a great neighborhood called El Barrio de las Letras. It's like a literature neighborhood or something, called Huertas as well, which is a neighborhood in great splendor. You have You have as well galleries and shops and beautiful coffee shops and restaurants here. You can walk around. It's a great area of the city to come and enjoy art and enjoy, well, just walking around.
Well, we should mention that that's where we are right now and that we're both very proud residents of El Barrio de las Letras too. But I would have to agree with you there, Jesus. Well, let's talk cinema now. Spain's finance minister, Cristobal Montoro, came under fire this week after suggesting that cutbacks to industry subsidies were due to the fact that Spain wasn't making enough quality pictures. But if we look at what's on offer this month, there are actually quite a lot of Spanish titles defending themselves quite well at the box office. What's caught your eye in particular?
When I speak about Spanish cinema, I like to speak about Latin American cinema as well, because I think the language is our country. So, and even the Latin American cinema is mostly produced in Spain, and we have a kind of identity together with our language in common. And we have a new movie this week, Lucia Puenzo, which is an Argentinian director. And it's about a kind of a doctor, a Nazi doctor, hidden in the Patagonia in Argentina. And I think it's a great movie. It's, and we have as well another kind of Spanish new cinema, new comedians coming up, like La Gran Familia Española, the big Spanish, the great Spanish family, it could be translated by Daniel Sánchez Arévalo, which is, the new Almodóvar for me. Our economy minister is saying that Spanish cinema is not well received by the public because of its lack of talent, which I don't think it's real. I think it's the lack of help by the government mostly, which is like killing Spanish cinema. Although the quality of our Spanish cinema is proved all around the world and is the best way to keep what they said, what the government trying to impose, called La Marca España, the Spanish label. And the Spanish label is, for example, mostly Almodóvar and Trueba things. And, well, all those people that they're trying to finish with.
That was Jesus Ruiz Mantilla, cultural editor of El País Semanal, speaking to our man in Madrid, Liam Aldous.
And that, unfortunately, brings us to the end of this week's review. Our show today was produced by Katie Bilboa and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Claire Urban. Up next, we hand back to Georgina Godwin, who continues the weekend edition, where after the headlines, you can catch this week's edition of The Curator.
The review will return next week with an international look at the Frieze Art Fair. And don't forget that if you've missed any of our shows, they can all be downloaded from monocle.com and on iTunes. But for now, it's goodbye from all of us at Midori House. You've been listening to The Review with me, Andrew Muller, and Clemency Burton Hill. Have a great weekend.